Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday, May 27th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today, we're going to talk about Senate Bill 1287. We have a public hearing on the bill, and this relates to the acquisition of sites under Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution, the newly adopted Measure 66 issue. The bill that we heard in our Shannon Committee allowed the purchase of Thompson's Mills, and it has a significant ways and means implication. So we want to take that issue up and discuss all of the implications. Perhaps we could start with is there anything for the good of the order that you'd like to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make the committee aware that in front of you is the staff measure summary from the Substantive Committee and the fiscal impact statement, and then amendments to the bill that is going to be discussed today.
Okay. A little background that brings us to the bill itself, the fiscal impact and the amendment. The bill authorizes the purchase of a Thompson's Mills associated property and water rights. Thompson's Mill, I will call up the owner, Dave Gravis, and we'll talk about the history in a bit. But it is one of the oldest water-powered, continuously operating mills, and it has a water right on it that predates Davis. And it's a significant water right. It's just about all the water there is in the Calpeca River. It is one of those things that, in the judgment of the committee, the SRT committee, deserves consideration for purchase under the park portion and possibly also the habitat portion of Measure 66 funds. We've had communications since the framing of this bill from the governor's office indicating that he would want to see this and all the other potential purchases put in a rank order, a framework, and put to public policy for discussion. And so that is the reason that the bill comes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with an amendment. The amendment has not been considered by the SRQ committee, and as we all know, the SRQ committee was shut down for this session. So we've sent the bill to Ways and Means because of the relatively large fiscal impact, but we've also brought the amendment here for consideration of the committee because it's likely that we will ask the committee to consider this amendment here. What I'd like to do is bring up Dave Babbitts, and we'll talk about a little of the background history on Thompson's Mill, and then we'll talk to Mr. Beerley and Mr. Wolf. So we'll bring Mr. Babbitts forward if that's
Thank you. For the record, Dave Babbitts, owner of Thompson's Mills. As the chairman alluded to, the amendments that are before you were designed to deal with some of the issues that came up after the Salmon Committee hearing. And we thought that we were accomplishing a couple of goals. There was some heartburn over the fact that we were tapping into a very large sum of money and essentially forcing the state to buy the property. So the amendments were designed to remove the word shall buy and instead conduct a study, or an appraisal that would keep us moving towards an acquisition. Yeah, the other thing that they did was they created the prioritized list that we hear so much about but nobody has ever really seen, and recommended that Thompson's Mills be placed on that prioritized list for acquisitions by Parks And the last thing we did with those amendments was we built in some protection for us, because we feel that there is a great deal of interest in acquiring our water rights but not paying for them. So the last part of the amendments requires that if the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife decides that they absolutely have to have more water for fish passage, then we're willing to provide, we're willing to do that as long as they pay for it in the form of a lease or taking out an option to purchase. That pretty much is what the amendments were designed to do. From a historical perspective, since the mill was built in 1858 prior to statehood, it suffered a great deal of traumatic hardship. There's been a lot of people that have spent their whole lives that worked at the mill. I know of one individual that got off the train in the 20s and walked out to the mill, fired on, and spent the rest of his life there and lived in our house. The mill owner's house also was a boarding house at that time, and most of the crew lived there. Senator Ferrioli indicated he wanted a little bit of the historical background information provided this morning, so I'll just do that real quickly. From a chronological standpoint, the mill was built to supply the gold rush. They supplied flour for the gold rush. They were on a major crossroads that north, south, and east, west, so we also supplied flour for the east side of the mountains. From a standpoint of first, the mill had the first post office in the area. It had the first concrete silos built south of Portland. The first electric power was generated at this mill for the central Willamette Valley. Long before anybody else had any power, we had a light bulb that burned on top of the mill so that everybody knew that that's where the power was in this part of the country. Sometime in the 40s, flour production ceased, and it mostly derived from two factors. One factor was that during World War II, a lot of the women who had traditionally been in the home and baked all of their bread products and pastries had gone to work for the war effort. And as a result of that, there was a sudden increase in the need for pre-baked products. So that took away part of the market. But the other thing that happened was, along about that time, we started seeing more government regulations that required people to, that were in the food processing business, to be more sanitary and more careful in how they produced their human consumptive products. So about the late 40s, we phased out flour production and continued our feed production, which we did until 1987. And during the 1980s, what we saw was a recession in the early part, and in the latter part, we had the spotted owl situation kick in. What happened to us was most of our customer base were mill workers. And when the mill workers lost their jobs through mill closings from the recession, followed on mill closings by the spotted owl, our customer base disappeared. So our gross sales went from over $1 million to around $400,000. And at that point, we started generating electricity for sale as supplemental income. When we did that, we opened the door to the fish and wildlife people, because we had to have a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license to generate power. And when we opened the door to get that license, we also eventually had to make some concessions. We had to put in some fish screens, which we agreed to do, and we absorbed the cost of that. We absorbed the cost of the water to operate those systems. But what's happened now is we have had an endangered species listing, and we have ODFW with a proposal that is going to, what we think, take about one-third of our water rights. We had an analysis done of our water rights to try and place a value on them, and what we came out with was a based on the replacement cost of irrigation rights, which is the only thing we can compare to. If the state had to go buy water for fish passage for in the Kalapuya Basin, it would have to come from irrigators, or it has to come from us. One or the other. There's no place else for the water to come from. So the value of the irrigation rights were what the economists finally looked at and came up with a value that ranged from, on the high end, $2 to $3.5 million for that one third of our water rights. And that water, if it were in consumptive use and used for irrigation purposes, it would be enough water to irrigate about 35,000 acres. It's a huge water right. It is not, we're not talking about water for domestic use here. It's a vast, very difficult to comprehend size. Getting back to our amendments, that's why we have placed in protection in the bill for the irrigators. Section 4 of the bill deals with water right issues, and we understand there's some heartburn over those with a number of the agencies, but I would point out that first of all, when the state of Oregon sells a piece of property to an individual, they typically withhold the mineral rights. That's just a very commonly done thing. And I would say that here we are withholding the state's ability to call the water rights on this issue. It is not something that's going to affect any other water rights. It is not setting a precedent. It is just protecting the irrigators so that they do not have to fight the fight that we have fought with ODFW over the last 20-some years. Pretty much, I know there's other people that want to testify, and I know you guys want to move on, so I would just like to wind down at this point and take questions if there are any.
Questions? That sounds good.
Have to clarify, it was my understanding in earlier conversations that you and your family's property, you know, retains 100% of the water rights to the Kalapuya River at your site. Is it 100%, or is it, you know, virtually 100%, or is it, you know, almost all of it? What, you know, can you give me an accurate statement on that?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. Mr. Chair, Representative King, are you referring to the ratio of the water rights that we hold compared to the other people in the basin?
Let me ask the question in a different way, and maybe that'll help you. It was my understanding, right or wrong, that at, you know, at your property, you know, pulling on the river, that you owned all the water rights, you know, to the river, you know, at that point. What that exactly means, I'm not sure. But then when I, you know, discussed your circumstance with the governor's office and my concerns, you know, for your situation, they were saying, well, it's not true. You know, they don't own 100% of the water, you know, rights, you know, at that point. And so I was just trying to, you know, get some clarification on that.
Chair Ferrioli, Representative King, we hold, for power purposes, 180 cubic feet per second water rights, in water rights. Probably, depending on what the climate is doing, how much rainfall we're getting, it does vary. From, say, April through October, 100% of the water in the river is ours for power purposes, so long as we're working within the boundaries of our water rights. The rest of the time, their flows may exceed that 180 CFF, and when they do, that belongs to whoever else has the entire appropriated water rights that are junior to us. Is that kind of get
right? Yeah, that helps that
In the flood of 96, we estimated that we had about 4,500 cubic feet per second that we were passing through at the mill.
And then the about how many miles of California River above you would you regard as viable salmon habitat?
Sheriff Ferry, only
comment on the status of that of the salmon running by.
Right. Sheriff Ferrioli, Representative King, I'm not a biologist, and I do not know all of the criteria that are used for determining what is and what is not good salmon habitat. However, I think that generally accepted standards say that most of the spawning grounds are located above Holly, and that much between our site and the city of Brownsville, which is probably about 8 to 10 river miles, is down on the valley floor, so it probably would not be considered as good of habitat as, say, the higher elevations where their water is cooler and faster flowing. But I'm not a biologist, so I'm really not qualified to answer those questions.
But my memory was it was about 18 miles of habitat, but maybe that's lower.
Above us.
Yeah.
It's probably something along those lines.
And you have five dams in your area of with authority. Is that true?
Yeah.
And that the salmon seem to cohabit with that, or or is there a blockage there that we need to be addressing so we can improve that access to the habitat?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, of the five dams that we hold, one is a rock and brush dam that blocks off a slough and maintains our flow to the mill. It has no fish passage, and there are not considered to be fish in the slough. The spillway dam has no fish passage on it, and it also is designed to maintain not only flow at the mill, but also the head, the depth of the water, the height of the fall. The mill itself has no fish passage facilities for upstream passage unless we are in the process of doing work where the mill race is drained and then the gates are all open. And that we consider that a dam. The other two dams, the shear dam is a low dam that is about 6 feet high. It has a fish ladder on it for upstream passage. We have always maintained that there are no fish in that part of the system. We have never seen any, and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been trapping that fish ladder this year in an effort to determine whether we're correct or they're correct, and so far we're winning that. They have not caught any fish in that ladder. The Sodom Dam is our main diversion dam. It is about a 8 foot high dam, roughly 100 feet across, has a fish passage ladder on it, and the ODFW is trapping that ladder, and they have to date, I believe, trapped less than 100. I know they've trapped less than 100 fish of the winter steelhead run. They are only trapping 4 days a week, though. So that's pretty much the fish move. We try to put most of the water, the excess water, down the bypass channel on that dam because that has the best fish ladder. And it also has the straightest, cleanest channel so that the ease of migration for the upstream migrating fish is expedited. And based on the trapping results this year, it looks like that that has probably been a wise thing to do.
And I imagine you feel that you're kind of in the crosshairs of the salmon Endangered Species Act, you know, issues, and that seeing that you have so much, you know, water rights there, that there's a lot of impact in terms of how you can get on with your life as long as, you know, there's a threat of losing, you know, some of your water or, you know, some of your dams to the salmon issues. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Canning, I think that as soon as NIMS remembers where we're at, we're going to be in big trouble. I think that they're going to come in and they're going to reiterate the demands that ODFW has already made for enhanced fish passage. They're going to do that under our FERC exemption. And we may choose to have our FERC exemption rescinded to get out from under the onus of that and revert back to our original power claims and use power on site only rather than sell it. The only reason that they have jurisdiction over us at this point is because we sell power into the interstate grid.
Thank you. Thank you for the answer, Tim.
That's great. Thanks for the question. That's right. Any further?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Connick.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about your 3-1909 water rights so far, and yet in the staff measure summary, I see it mentions 1933 and 1958 water rights. So it confuses me. Can you just briefly enlighten me a little bit?
Senator Ferriola, Senator Tarno, we hold a number of water rights. The legislature in 1909 decided that water had to be regulated. And we were already using a considerable amount of water at that time. I think that the Thompson family was very frugal. And what they did was they registered the original power claim at 35 CFS and an 1858 priority date. And I think that the reason that they did that was because there was a fee. You had to pay money. And at that time, most of the transactions being conducted at the mill were barter. And it's pretty hard to pay your water fee with a sack of flour. So what they did was they registered their claim for the lowest amount of the stream flow, which also got them down, and I can't remember what the fee schedule was. I've seen it, but it got it down to where they were paying next to nothing. At that time, we were running two turbines. We had a 42-inch and a 24-inch turbine, and I certainly know that they were using more than 35 CFS in water. In 1932 and 33, the mill was in an expansion process. We were pouring concrete flumes. We poured the concrete, the shear dam, the one that has a fish ladder on it. And at that point, another turbine was added, apparently. And my understanding is that they figured that they better toe the line and get the rest of their water registered up. So that's why we have that. And the 1985 right, we were forced to go through a long, involved process because even though we had been generating electricity, we were not selling it. And so we were not grandfathered in. So in 1985, we went through a process both with the state and the federal government that set us up so that we could sell power. We didn't change anything except use.
Thank you. Any further? I may ask you to come back, Mr. Davis, but I'd like to hear from some folks from the parks that see you here today. And you had a communication yesterday by fax, and actually there is a document to be distributed today. Good morning.
Okay. And we're coming to here.
That's pretty sensitive, though.
Mm-hmm.
and that would capture the
yeah. Are your ears?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Weiner, Deputy Director of Parks and Recreation. And before you today, a letter that Director Myman wanted shared in terms of the commission's position on Thompson's Mill. There were some reports in the newspapers and such that the commission had already taken action essentially to approve acquisition of the property, and that's not the case. The commission has toured this property and looked at the facility and recognizes it as a historic site, but there were disagreements about the appraised value that came back, and the feasibility study raised questions about how the department might manage such a property long term, given the financial situation of the department at the time. So, for the record, that's, we wanted to clarify what action the commission had or had not taken on this property.
I'm just Jim Locker. I'm here in case there were any questions that came up.
You're not just Jim Locker.
He testified before on this issue in your other committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Be happy to.
Communication that we received indicates a couple of interesting things. One is that the commission did visit this issue in 1994, and the past committee was a summary of the information that was discussed in 1994 in the form of a meeting minutes from April 14, 1994. And item I on the page 5 of the, well, 5 on my fax copy, unnumbered page 13 in your copy that was distributed. It talks about the feasibility study, and it appeared to me that the issue discussed most in the minutes isn't the question about whether or not this property was historical or of importance to the community for a variety of reasons, but primarily revolved around the fact that even though the commission recognized the value of the property as a historical and potential acquisition target, it was the dollars that were not available to acquire the site in 1994 that was a key focus of the discussion. Care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, since I'm new to this organization, having been there 6 weeks, I'll only comment to say I wasn't part of this particular discussion, nor was Mr. Lockwood, but the issue before us, I think, still is the cost of the acquiring the property, but also managing this property long term, because there are multiple issues, as you're aware, I think, of with a historic property like this in terms of operating the facility. And those are the issues the commission takes into account and would need to consider also.
Mm-hmm. The feasibility study that was mentioned in 1994 was completed, was it not?
Was completed?
Yes. Could we get copies of the feasibility study? Okay. If the committee members would like to see it. Senator Pine.
Yeah, I got a copy of the fiscal on these things. And what is curious, because the it shows the expenditures for 1999-2001 is $9.2 million. It also indicates at the bottom of the fiscal that $3.5 million is for long-term improvements, preservation, restoration, etc. For long-term improvements, why is it part of the 1999-2001 budget package?
I'm referring to the back of the fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, Senator Turner. My sense is that down there in the table where it adds up the money, the initial stabilization improvements is what I think of as what we have to do at the outset. I can't speak to why long term would be in the first year. Maybe Mrs. Warner might.
That would change, wouldn't that change in the fiscal for 1999 and 2001?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, I would see that it might. I just don't know. I'm not sure that if there isn't something that we build in there in terms of part of the thing I'm not sure about is that under initial stabilization improvements for public use, you know how you do the handicapped access to restrooms and the safety for children and parking lots and so on. I'm not sure if there's some reason that the long-term piece is thought of more as a capital investment that's different somehow. I just don't know. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Turner, I did not construct this fiscal impact statement, but in terms of thinking about what the long-term improvements would be, there may be identifying that we need $3.5 million to start addressing those issues and would do that over a period of time. There would be some initially. I have not seen the buildings. I don't know in terms of the restoration and preservation, but those are expensive to take care of in terms of preservation projects.
Mr. Chair, my concern is I don't see how State Parks can spend $9 million in two years on this thing. And that's my point. I'm just wondering why it shouldn't be spread out over a longer period of time.
I think we understand. We would have the same question later, correct?
That's one unanswerable. We'll revisit that one. The note that came with the documents distributed by the Parks Department has a paragraph that addresses the $9 million, as a matter of fact, and it says the basis for the fiscal impact statement comes directly from the information generated by that feasibility study. So we'll get copies of the study for the committee and be able to connect the dots that way. But I agree, I think that question begs an answer. The further communication in my memo from Parks Director Robert Myron is that the Commission has adopted criteria for acquisition and a priority list, and that there are several properties listed on that priority list, and this, of course, is not on the priority list. And I just wondered if anybody here could briefly address some of the criteria that are articulated in that letter.
Mr. President, members of the committee, the criteria acquisition and priority criteria are on the second page of the packet that you have. And there's a long list of items that the commission evaluates, and I think the acquisition sort of midway down, there's public demand and acquisition measures the level of effort required to secure the site, the willing seller, the number of landowners, and availability of funding. And I think that's what you were referring to in terms of the main concern at the time was funding and operation of this particular facility and not reaching an agreement on that being available within the resources.
Questions?
Other
criteria,
but that were evaluated at the time, and I don't know what exactly where Thompson's Mill fell on some of these other evaluation points.
Okay. Representative Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just along those same lines, I guess maybe where you've answered it, I was wondering where Thompson Mill would fit in the evaluations. Do you have a evaluation form that you went through and answered all those questions in relation to Thompson Mill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anthony, they're not at the Parks Department long enough to be able to give you a very good answer to that, and perhaps we just need to get back to you with some more information about how much of an evaluation this site went through at the time. I think if you look at the list, if I might, of the properties, there is a listing of the properties the Commission does have on the list for acquisition, and that might help you get some kind of context of what they were looking at the time, the geographic dispersion, and some of the facilities offer multiple types of recreational opportunities.
Relative to the acquisition priorities, is this just the first five, or is this the complete list?
This is the complete list at the time.
At 1994?
Currently.
Currently.
Current list.
Okay. And those are Whalen Island, Tillamook County, South Beach State Park Edition in Lincoln County, Cape Sebastian in Curry County, Fort Yamhill Edition in Polk County, and Sisters Rock in Curry County.
Correct.
Those are all coastal recreation type properties.
Mr. Chair, with the one for Fort Yamhill, a little bit inland, actually it's more of a historic fort. people would say it's in the general area of the casino on where they're
coming. And the total amount of the acquisition for those is $8.3 million. And you are a beneficiary of Measure 66 and infusion, and there was a significant appropriation in the last legislative session.
The last time for renovation and rehabilitation, that's what you're referring to.
So it would appear that you have acquired resources that would allow you to fill all the acquisition priorities that are currently identified, if you wish to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, the current budget coming out of this session right now has $4 million identified for acquisition projects. So those are the resources that the commission will have to work with in terms of considering property purchase to acquire. And the department, of course, as you have received a number of requests from all over the state for various acquisitions that people think would be important to the system beyond what's currently on this list.
Are you developing a mechanism for dealing with those suggestions?
Mr. Chair, we're in that process, yes, and we're to report back to the legislature, to the emergency board on what that criteria is and the process that will be used to go through evaluation of those properties.
And relative to the emergency board, there was an appropriation made to the emergency board, at least as I understood it, there was a set-aside in the E board.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that our budget bill went back to subcommittee for Ways and Means, and they have subsequently removed the set-aside at the E-Board and actually put it into the Department of Appropriation and asked them to report back to the emergency board.
And
a whole different mechanism.
What was the total amount that had been set-aside?
Originally, it was $3 million, I believe, that was set aside in the E-Fund, and the budget now has $4 million that's coming out of the session.
Okay. Further questions?
You know, since you're addressing acquiring property here, and you know, so that's subject to negotiations that might be confidential, is it possible that we're not going to be able to get all the information associated with these trades, or is this all taken care of, and we're just dealing with appraisals, and that's all things we can know the full status of?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, the commission has an executive session where they consider land purchases in, because some of that is confidential, and then they come out of session, executive session, and actually approve the purchases, but the discussions themselves surrounding that is part of the executive sessions, which are not public record.
Thank you. And are all these properties on the current priority list, are they accessible by car?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I can't answer that question. I don't know.
And then if you did the...
I can let you know.
The reason I ask that is that we see a prospective acquisition value that's, you know, some analysis of about $4 million, and then we see the rest of the costs that go along with, you know, getting it up to pro forma. And here on the priority list, we're seeing the acquisition costs, which doesn't include the, you know, the cost of having it become a park, and I was, you know, wondering what cents of dollars one might, you know, falling behind what these totals are. So if we're looking at something that's in the neighborhood of $7 million, and we're looking at something that's like $35 million by the time it's all at this net.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I think that's a good point in terms of these pieces just identify the acquisition costs and don't address the development costs. The department goes through a process of master planning where they, once they acquire pieces of property and determine that they're going to become parks, they go through a planning phase of identifying what is that property going to be. Is it campsites? Is it a day use area? Exactly what it is. And then the engineering department can determine projected costs at that point for actually the development costs and then the operational costs of those facilities. So it is sort of a three-phase process, and this, what you're seeing is just the dollars for the initial purchase price.
So if we acquired these five properties, would that look at the prospect of maybe consuming your budget resources for the next 10 or 20 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, it possibly, we don't know what that would look like in terms of operational costs, so it would be hard to say what piece of the budget that might be and what revenues might be available from the department, because development of farm properties, like into camping facilities, generates revenues that cover the operation of their costs. So I'm not trying to not answer your question, but I don't have a good, succinct way of saying what that would be.
Further questions? Thank you very much. We have some other folks signed up, but I guess I'd like to ask Ken Beerley and Ms. Cagle, can I ask you to come forward? And I've got some water use questions.
For the record, my name is Ken Beerley with Governor's Natural Resource Office. I've drawn the short straw to speak to you today about Senate Bill 1287. And the deliberations that you are conducting right now are the kinds of deliberations that the governor feels are very appropriate for making decisions about investment of significant resources that were made available by very popular ballot initiative. The proposed site before you is one that has, on the surface, looks like very appropriate investment. It has water rights available that are very old water rights. It has a historic structure that is relatively unique in the Willamette Valley. The bigger questions that it raises, however, are how important is this historic structure among other properties that would be available as state parks throughout the state? And it raises the issue of, is this water right the most important for fish recovery in the Willamette Basin? And to be very candid, we don't have good, clear answers on those issues. And so the governor would like to see prioritization for acquisition of parks by the State Parks Department in an open public process to get deliberation from people throughout the state on what those priorities might be. He is specifically concerned about limiting water rights in a measure that would dedicate resources for acquisition. Feels that negotiation between landowner and the state on those water rights is the appropriate mechanism for that, but let the market determine the value based on what the state receives against those water rights. And if there are less than full water right available, then the less than full value should be paid. So it appears that they're, by structuring in law some restriction on the amount of water rights that the state could acquire, would provide significant limitations both on what benefit would be obtained as well as what the negotiating opportunities between the two parties might be. Be glad to answer questions. We recognize that this is an important site. The question is, how important is it among the other sites that the state has? And we don't have real good answers to that. The governor will be directing, working with State Parks Department to develop a priority list. And through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, there is specific language in House Bill 3225 that directs that board to develop priorities for salmon and stream restoration. Those priorities will help provide a template for decisions like these in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Martha Cagle, Water Resources Department. I'm primarily here to answer questions that you might have about
how this bill would affect the water rights, but let me just offer a few thoughts by way of background. That from the standpoint of water rights and the water law as it relates to this bill and this project, it's kind of puzzling. There are a number of things that are unclear the way the bill is currently structured that make it hard to figure out exactly what was intended and what the impact would be on the water rights. For example, you've heard discussion that the water rights are huge, that it's basically all of the water at that location during a large part of the year, which is true in the sense of the amount of CFS that is allocated under 35 CFS under a water right that is prior to the 1909 water code, and the remainder 145 with the 1933 water right. But then the bill goes on to say that they could only use the water and make a call at 15 CFS. So you've taken a water right for 180 CFS, but limited its usefulness or your ability to demand the water to 15 CFS. So there's a dramatic change in the paper water right to what is actually used. Typically, a water right, or the law provides that a water right goes with the land. So if you sell the land, the water right goes along with it. And the new owner of the land has the prerogative to use the water right, you know, according to the terms and limits of the water right, but they could also transfer the water to something else. The current owner could transfer the water right before they sell the land, and then the land would come without the water right. But if that doesn't happen first, the water rights go with the land, and typically the new owner, in this case if it were State Park, would have the full prerogative to manage that water the way they saw fit. As I understand it, historically at this location, there has been a voluntary agreement, what we call a rotation agreement, and that is provided for in the law. That there's a mechanism by which the water right holders on a stream can get together and figure out a more efficient way to allocate their water, and they can go through a process, and that can be recognized. So there's a mechanism in the law right now that would allow State Park to work with the other affected water right holders upstream to try to maintain, you know, a working system on that river. But what this bill would appear to do is to try to take elements of that current working arrangement and put it into the statute, but not all of the elements are in that. So it's just so puzzling from that standpoint. It's also puzzling in the sense that it would, on the one hand, direct State Park to maintain certain animal growth of fish passage, and then in another part it says if Fish and Wildlife wants fish passage, then they have to buy it. And that's, I'm referring to the new amendment, subsection 4 of the amendment. It's just not clear there whether that's intended to apply only if the current owners retain the ownership, and then that would be an arrangement between Fish and Wildlife and the current owners, or whether that's still part of Park. So I've probably raised as many questions as so far I'm able to answer, but maybe that's instructive in and of itself.
It is. Questions? Senator Gersh.
The water that the water right, once it comes through the mill, what happens to that water? Does it go back into the stream? Does it divert it? Okay, so we're not talking about water disappearing and going out on the agricultural lands and being percolated into the soil.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator George. As I understand it, the issues here are more dealing with upstream junior water users who ordinarily the mill would have the right to have all of that water delivered to that site in the full amount, and an arrangement now exists whereby they don't take that full amount consistently, and it's diverted upstream by junior users.
Further? The water right is described as a non-consumptive right. Give me a thumbnail definition of what a non-consumptive use is, or what are non-consumptive uses.
Mr. Chair, typically hydroelectric, or in this case hydromechanical, right, take the water for a short period of time, run it through the system, and then put it back into the stream. And the whole amount that was diverted to run the turbines or whatever is returned to the stream. And so it's viewed as non-consumptive. An in-stream water right is a non-consumptive water right because you're not taking the water out of the stream. Other types of uses, for example, municipal uses, divert a whole lot of water that they typically consume only a very small percentage of the total amount that's diverted, and a large amount then returns. Irrigation, there's a similar distinction between the total amount that is diverted, the amount that's actually consumed by the crop, and the amount that ultimately returns back into the system.
So those are the non-consumptive portions.
Yes. There is not typically, we don't issue a water right for, quote, non-consumptive uses, but there are certain types of water uses that are non-consumptive in the sense that they allow the water to be turned back to the stream.
You discussed the issue of the value of this water right relative to fish passage or habitat or others. What about the value of the right for mitigation purposes? Is mitigation a non-consumptive use and are mitigation rights assignable?
Mr. Chair, mitigation, are you talking about in-stream flow restoration by saying mitigation rights? We don't issue water rights for, quote, mitigation. We can issue in-stream water rights for in-stream flow. We have issued water rights to private parties or other governmental entities for fish enhancement, fish restoration. Those are non-consumptive in the sense that they are for in-stream flow purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
It does somewhat. We're looking at different ways of approaching incentives to bring folks to the table for a variety of purposes. And we've looked at pollution tax credits. We've looked at banking of various interests in environmental management, Department of Environmental Quality. Mitigation is an element that we've been looking at in a couple of the agency budgets. We tried to stimulate the idea that there might be a mitigation bank available. So I'm wondering whether or not mitigation is a non-consumptive use. And is it, you know, I guess I'm leading a little bit, but I see this non-consumptive use in this relatively large water right as being a potential for mitigation for use in a larger scheme of mitigation statewide.
Mr. Chair, theoretically, acquisition of a large water right would give you access to that water, which could then be used for mitigation purposes, as long as you could get it to the source where you needed the mitigation to occur. In this case, the limitation that's here is that they don't have the right to use that water. They have a paper water right for 180 CFS total, but they can't make a call on it until 15. So basically, a 15 CFS available, and that 15 CFS, as I understand it, is needed in that particular location for fish. So there's really not a usable quantity of water that you could then assign to a mitigation process. But theoretically, if the state or any entity were to acquire a water right and set it aside to be a source of water for mitigation purposes, that could work in the way you've described.
Mm-hmm. And would that mitigation only be available on the reach of the river where it occurs, where the water rights occurs?
Mr. Chair, the way it would work in this case is that it could only be used there, as I understand it. But if, for example, the source of your mitigation was a storage project, then if you could figure out a distribution system to get the water from the mitigation site, bank storage site, to the use site, there wouldn't be any limitations.
Okay, and I think that that all depends on the scale of your observation. You know, when viewed from a basin perspective, for instance, you might look at mitigation differently than you would if you look at just a reach of a river. And I think one of the things that we keep coming around to in the mitigation issues is how big a scale will mitigation strategies need to operate on. And if you're limited to a reach of a river for mitigation, that will severely limit the application of mitigation strategies in mitigation training.
I just respond that so far as we've been dealing with mitigation with respect to particular permit issues, particular water right issues, we're in working with either Department of Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries or whatever fish and wildlife agency we're dealing with, they're typically looking for mitigation to help minimize the impacts on that particular stream, on that particular fish. And so it has been pretty site specific. In some instances, we've talked about in other tributaries that would affect the same overall basin. But for the most part, you're trying to offset the impact at or above the location of the use.
Okay. I guess Ms. Tagos, I think it's our benefit maybe to knock the sideboards off that tension a little bit. You've heard the term bucket for bucket.
Certainly have.
And for the question, we're trying to get the committee to consider is where does the bucket have to be? If you have to have mitigation, can it be a basin-wide question rather than just a reach specific or an upstream question for mitigation?
Chair Tamberley, just with that's kind of what's going on in the Deschutes Basin right now. Yeah. We have a very large work group trying to develop a basin-wide mitigation plan with those kinds of considerations in mind.
And I see that this issue might intersect with that kind of thing.
The uniqueness, for the record, Tim Dearley with the Governor's Natural Resource Office, the uniqueness of this circumstance is that you basically have a dewatered section of stream where you have a water right for hydroelectric and hydromechanical purposes that takes water out of one portion of the stream, puts it back into the lower portion of the stream. So your effect is fairly localized. So that's part of the calculus in that larger game of mitigation mechanics. But this specific example is probably not the best one to start with.
Question? Representative Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how long this property has been offered for sale, but I have a real concern that with all we have going on now with the listings of fisheries and water rights issues and everything else, that we've got a situation here where a property owner, and I've been concerned about this with a lot of other situations, where their value of their assets potentially could be decreased. And I'm concerned that as this process is prolonged, that it's really not fair to this landowner or maybe other landowners caught in the same situation. That because of things that are out of your control as agencies, but primarily through what National Fisheries is doing and others, that it could have a tremendous impact. And I don't think it's without precedence. We just heard earlier this week with the Columbia Gorge Commission that the valuations that the Forest Service is using on those properties that they're trying to purchase is based on pre-gorge acquiring or decisions. And I'm just curious about maybe Mr. Bearley, your thoughts on if this kind of thinking would apply in this case as well.
For the record, Ken Dearley of Governor's Natural Resource Office, Chair Ferrioli, representing Messerly, it would be my understanding that any acquisition would take place between willing buyer and seller negotiating the price at the time of purchase. Appraisals done prior to, under different circumstances, would probably not be applicable. I understand the concern about the potential of larger societal issues affecting the value. I haven't seen that happen yet, but it is a possibility. It's one that there is legitimate concern about. I'm not quite sure how we address that uniformly. There are other people who could be affected in a similar way who don't happen to be here at our attention at the present time, and how do we do that equitably across the state? Don't quite know how to get there from here.
Mr. Chair, just follow up. Again, you know, and I've been concerned about this for a long time before I ever got to this building, but I was intrigued by the discussion we had with the Gorge Commission again, where they had worked out a formula that was based their appraisals on preconditions.
Thank you. Senator George.
I think this probably typifies exactly why our Constitution was written the way it was, and that is, if you take it paperless. And Ken, what I'm concerned about are a couple of things here. First of all, in the letter, the governor has previously expressed concern about the preemption of the administrative process. And yet right here, we have going clear back prior to 1994, an obvious involvement of government in this site. In fact, the statement here in those minutes, you know, from the Oregon Park Commission was, Thompson Mill is extreme significant resource. Okay, so I don't think if this thing was moved, there would be any preemption of an administrative process, because obviously it's been going on for a long time. But that is only part of the question I'm going to ask. The question I have is, if I have the power to regulate your property so that it is devalued, I can't then, on any assumption of fairness, come back and say, oh, because I've devalued your property, it's only worth one quarter of what it was prior to the time that I, as government, devalued it. Explain to me the fairness factor here on this.
Chair Farrelly, Senator George, there is no question that there is a concern about fairness when public laws that benefit the general public can have adverse effects on individuals. That happens across the board. And how we weigh and balance the equities there is not easy. There's no question about it. And the best way to do that, the way the governor proposes to do that, is to have an open public process rather than view each project individually on kind of its independent merits without looking at them as all the opportunities across the state and how we meet the needs of the people across the state. That's the issue about the public process. Because I think those two questions are very well linked. We recognize that as regulations tighten, there will be people affected. And if we have developed remedies, like Measure 66, where acquisition between willing buyers and sellers can help remedy the effects of regulation, then there should be at least equal, equitable access to those remedies. The fact that the Parks Commission has looked at that property means that it is an important property. The point that they have not put it on their list of under, 5 years ago criteria, it was not one of the primary properties for acquisition at that point in time, should tell us something as well.
Well, the problem then was revenue. You know, they were looking at $50 million budgets, and they weren't looking at Measure 66. Now they're looking at $97 million budgets, and with the possibility of accessing additional Measure 66 dollars for acquisitions like this. But I'm concerned as I look at the acquisition priorities when I see South Beach State Park on Lincoln County at Newport, and I see that they were going to purchase private land that might have an impact on the park. Where is the limit of this thing? This is $1 million that is going to be spent. We already own the park. We already own South Beach. Are we going to come in there at that location like we're doing at Thompsonville and devalue that property down to, let's say, $500,000? Or maybe it is worth $2 million now, that private property.
Senator Farrelly, Senator George, I think that you make a very good point that there should be a public deliberation process, and the Ways and Means has requested that the State Parks Department come back to them with a prioritization mechanism to evaluate properties. I think that's an appropriate mechanism to look at how these individual parcels, both those that have been identified historically and those that might come forward in the future or at the present time, could be looked at in relationship to one another.
Thank you, Senator George. Well, I guess the interesting thing to me is I didn't realize that there was an appraisal on the property already that was conducted in 1994. Obviously, that would have to be updated for any current valuation. I think there is a real question about the value and the utility of the water rights. And I think there's a broader issue about whether or not and how we approach water rights like this for mitigation purposes. And I think there's some real opportunity to look beyond the, sort of the think outside the box exercise that gives us more potential. We're going to need to develop almost any project now that we have seven listings in the state. And this, I think, is a good opportunity for us to focus some of our thinking in that direction.
There's been a significant cooperative effort looking at the availability of water and the limitation of water for anadromous fish production in the coastal basins and the Rogue and Umpqua basins that identifies priorities for acquisition. We're hoping that can be done in the Willamette Basin and throughout the rest of the state as well, but would provide us with the information on where the Calipuya might fit as a priority within the Willamette Basin. We hope that that can be done within the next year or so.
Okay. Senator Sherry, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that is exactly, you mentioned seven listings, and now all of a sudden we have somebody else other than the state government trying to devalue property. And I think what that's why it is so critical that we draw the line in the sand now and say when property is devalued by government, that it should be compensated. And I think this is one place to draw the line. The voters have appropriated money, and I think this needs to be the cornerstone of the concept that we're going to act in a constitutional way towards the citizens and taxpayers of the state.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? We have Mr. Wolf from Marion. He signed up for our testimony. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Yes, I'm Bruce Wolf from Marion County, and I guess I'm neutral on this, but I come from my experience of running Mission Mill Museum three blocks from here for 6 years. Mission Mill is about a 6-acre site, has a water turbine, historic building, and I was involved as a board member there in the early 80s, and the director left unexpectedly, and they asked me if I'd fill in as an interim director, and that lasted for 6 years. I learned a lot during that time about historic sites and the problems involved in dealing with historic preservation, volunteers, handicapped access, things like that. So I thought I would maybe share some of that with you. When I started, I didn't have a museum experience. I had an advanced degree in education, and I was retired from the Army, but through 6 years of involvement with the Oregon Museums Association and the Salem Historic Preservation Council and the Tourism Commission, I didn't get to be an expert, but I learned a lot. Some of the things, and I also did during the about 93-94 time frame visit the mill. A local architect and engineer were considering becoming involved in an assessment of the site, and I'm not sure whatever happened on that, but groups were invited to bid on an assessment process to determine, I guess, the feasibility of restoring it or maintaining it as a historic site. So we went down to visit the site and toured it. I was retired by then. These other fellows, after visiting the site, decided they had enough other things to do that they didn't want to pursue it. So I don't know whatever became of the effort, but if it did, was accomplished, it'd be interesting to see what an engineer and what an architect and I assume whoever got the contract also had some experience in administering historic sites, what their opinion of and the cost estimates for that effort would be. Some of the things that concerned me about the site was the accessibility. It's not an easy place to find. You can have a wonderful historic site, but unless it's well preserved and maintained and easily accessible, even as close as Mission Mill is to the Capitol, and all the school bus loads of children that come here to visit, they don't necessarily want to come over and visit your site, but if you're off the beaten track, I think you can assume that it's going to be a lot more difficult. And even if you can get them there, unless you can accommodate them well, and that's with heated, clean bathrooms, something to occupy up to 60 children at a time, it becomes very unmanageable. And those were some of the things that we wrestled with daily at Mission Mill. And they don't come spread out over the year. They come in April and May, especially when the legislature's in session. And
it's sort of like a trip to the zoo, isn't it?
It is.
I was referring to when the legislature...
Well, no, the children too. I mean, trying to hold the attention of 60 teenagers, middle schoolers or something, is a challenge. And but also you have the safety considerations, and I mean, it's a wonderful site, and I don't want to degrade that, but so was Mission Mill, and trying to interpret our water turbine and interpret our the machinery we had there presents some real challenges. I think essential in the operation of almost any historical site is the involvement of volunteers and the accessibility of a significant volunteer base. I didn't see that there. We stopped and had coffee in one of the restaurants and engaged in conversation with some of the local people just to see how what they thought and wondering how quickly they would rise to the defense of or support of the mill. And it was, of course, it's kind of hard to be popular in someone's backyard, too, because they maybe take it for granted. But I see that as a disadvantage because you really need a pretty strong volunteer base in order to, if you're going to interpret it without you spending a lot of money for state employees. Part of any historic site operation is the maintenance of it. And old buildings are hard to maintain. And I don't know about their turbine, but when we got in the middle of the winter and one of those significant freezes we have every 3 or 4 years created real problems for us. And here you're operating a historic site and nobody comes. I mean, we had days at Mission Mill where we were located where we'd have 3 visitors, but you had to still be open and staff someone to take tickets, someone to give tours, if you have a gift shop, as I already mentioned, restrooms. So then going with that is education. I think having a site without education is you're not meeting your full obligation. That takes some space to accommodate people, to educate them, and somebody to put together a program and to conduct the program. Once again, probably volunteers, unless you're going to have a number of staff. I noticed that their staffing recommendation was 2 people. Are you operating 7 days a week? 2 people have a difficulty keeping a place open 7 days a week, 52 weeks out of the year. So I suspect that that's a little bit conservative. And I'm not sure about the total size, but when you mow the lawns and keep places clean, and that, those are some of the things that I wrestled with daily there at Mission Mill. In fact, the first 6 months I was there, I didn't draw a salary because we couldn't afford to pay it. And people expect a place to be clean, safe, and presentable. And those are the difficulties I see the parks and recs having in other places. And when I read the paper, that's why I came. I saw the paper. They were talking about this. And I said, gosh, we have these other places that can't operate. They want to add another one. They realize what they're getting into. So I guess my main concern was that you realize the funding limitations and you go into this with your eyes open, and is it part of the prioritized list, and where does it fit on that prioritized list? And if I can answer any questions that you might have, I'd be glad to.
When I look at the pictures of the Thompson Mill and remember what Mission Mill looked like, would you describe how you would compare the two as far as the condition of at the time they were acquired?
Well, Mission Mill was totally overgrown when it was needed new roofs and all of that. And I don't really know the true condition of the Thompson Mill now. I haven't been there for 5 years. And that was that study, if they ever conducted it with an engineer and an architect, would have, because it's hard to tell from the surface. I know when we got into Mission Mill, there were huge beams that had to be replaced, and we had to do a lot of structural reinforcement and these old wooden buildings. And I don't know if it's sprinkled. Mission Mill was sprinkled, but that had to be updated. But what a loss that would be if that caught fire. And most of these older structures, fire was and I think still is a real concern.
We're looking at the fiscal on this, and obviously you've seen it too, and they're showing $5 million over the cost of just the acquisition. How much was spent on this and that?
It was piecemeal, probably, and it was done by a nonprofit. It makes a big difference. Probably maybe $2 to $3 million, but we were doing it on the real cheap. I mean, that was what we did, was we scrounged and begged and borrowed and tried every way possible. I mean, and our top salary at the time was like $22,000 with no benefits. And I notice here personnel is looks like it's close to $100,000 by the time you figure personnel costs in. So it's, I think, hard to make that kind of a comparison.
Further questions? Well, you brought some unique perspectives, and I sure appreciate you coming in today. The work that folks have done with Mission Mill is just incomparable, and I wonder if the community had not responded when the condition of the mill was questionable, whether or not it was worth more for the community to step up to the plate and form a nonprofit association of friends to save the mill. You know, that is a decision that people make in a community very often. And to think that it might have been bulldozed or let burn or let fall into the, you know, into the channel, it would be a tremendous loss. And I think that's the kind of situation that you're going to face frequently. And now that there is a dedicated fund to the that's constitutionally mandated for this purpose, I think that helps solve some of these problems and answer some of the questions. Although I think you're bringing the issue of priorities is certainly a good thing to do. You need to find a mechanism to establish those priorities. But I'm glad that that wasn't something that you had to face with Mission Mill. If you had to list Mission Mill with a list of other potential priorities statewide and compete, I don't know if we've seen the effect that a few dedicated individuals that stepped up to the plate and said, we're going to save this mill. And that was a community-based decision. It wasn't a competitively bureaucratic process. It was just a dedicated decision, and maybe that's the best way to get to these things. I worry about what would happen if you have to bottom line a few of these decisions, and that means, you know, there's a steam-powered mill in Bellflower. It's the oldest steam-powered sawmill still operating in North America. Thompson's Mill is another unique in terms of the fact that it's still an operating mill. It could be a living museum. There's several other facilities like that in Oregon. I'd hate to decide that three of them didn't make the list and therefore would not be artifacts that we would hand down to our children because we had a competitive process. We ranked them at the bottom of the list, and therefore we had nothing available. So I just commend what you've done at Mission Mill and all the volunteers and the effort that went in there. Just an extraordinary asset for the community. And maybe that wasn't and won't be recognized for another 50 years, how critically important it is to keep those things. It's just a real good job that you've done. So you pass that along to the others. I think every person...
Well, I'm no longer involved. I retired from there in 92, but I still help out at times. So.
I think every person in the room has been to the facility and enjoyed it tremendously.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other person here present that wishes to offer testimony on this? Step up. Come on down. Good morning.
Good morning. Glenn Harrison from Albany. Had not anticipated giving testimony, but might as well sign up.
You're on the list, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Have at her.
I am the president of the Linn County Historical Society and treasurer for Boston Mill Society. While I appreciate the comments that have been made earlier concerning prioritization, I would encourage both the State Parks Commission and this committee in its deliberations of use of ballot measure 66 funds to move the Thompson's Mill project to a higher position on the priority list so that it can be included. It is a significant site. We do have a volunteer group that is doing some work in trying to raise funds. We've placed a sign the property. We have received a plan for interpretation. So things are in the works. If it becomes something that's available, through a grant, Linn County did have a study done that was referred to. The Leland study is out. The appraisal would need to be updated, and I think that can be done, including the water rights issue, so that both the state and the property owner would know what fair market value would be, including the water rights.
Mr. Harrison, the Leland study is available. Could we impose upon you to get a copy, and actually you can have it back. We'll make copies for the committee. They're probably pretty precious. So the Boston, there's a Boston, Friends of the Boston Mill. Or
Boston Mill Society. Boston is the historic name before the Thompson family purchased it. And at your other committee, Martin Thompson was one of the people who gave testimony, and it was his grandfather and uncle and then a cousin who were the mill owners in the Thompson family.
Is there any reference in the Leland study to the potential for the site to drive visitors into Lynn County or Keaton for a day trip? Or is that for the, and I imagine the Chamber of Commerce has also taken up a position on development.
I'm not sure if they have it.
I think they have. Any further or any questions for Mr. Harrison? And it's, I imagine it's a fairly high priority for the Lynn County Historical Society. Do you have anything comparable?
There is nothing. This is the largest mill west of the Mississippi that's still in operation.
And I understand that it's one of the 11 most endangered of its type in the country.
We have nominated it for that position. Announcement has not been made, whether it made the list or not.
Okay. Further questions? Great. And is there any further testimony on this issue? Mr. Gravitt, if you'd like to come forward.
For the record, Dave Babbitt, Thompson's Mills. I'd just like to just clarify a couple of things. The Leyland study was commissioned by the Lynn County Commissioners in 1993 or 94. There were $65,000 were contributed to that study by the federal government, and the county commissioners had in kind, so the cost of the study was on the verge of $125,000 to $130,000. It was very detailed, and the figures that the Parks Department was quoting for their costs to preserve and protect and develop this site of $5 million looked very similar to the high-end costs that were in this study. They had three scenarios, a low, medium, and high cost. And the high cost assumed that they were going to go right after it, dump a lot of money into it, fully develop the site on a very short time frame. And they also projected that there would be something like $2 to $3 million worth of direct economic benefit to the county. Over 100,000 visitors a year. It was on the full-blown project. There were offsetting incomes to help offset those costs. And that will come out in the report, and I will make sure that you get a copy of it also. The reason that the deal fell through in 1994 was twofold. We ran into public opposition from local farmers. They were concerned that their needs were not being taken care of on transportation issues and also on water issues. The other reason that the deal fell through was the appraisal came in at $700,000, and we felt that the appraisal was flawed because water issues, there again, were not addressed, and we felt that there was a great deal of value to the water. We were told by State Parks that they felt that the appraisal was a good one. They would not redo it. And furthermore, if we chose to have an appraisal done, they would not accept it. It's pretty tough to deal with that kind of thing other than just to walk away from it. And the last thing I want to try to clarify on the water issues that Director Pagel brought up, we're not limiting the state's ability to utilize the water for milling purposes or fish passage for that matter. What we are attempting to limit is their ability to call the river. And that affects all of the other water users in the entire basin, 180,000 acre basin. The call level being set at 15 CFS is low enough that they'll never be able to call the river. we want to be frank about that. And that was the intent and the purpose of setting that level at that flow. But that language does not limit the state from using the water to operate the mill or through an interagency agreement between parks and ODFW so that they can manage the water for fish passage. They need to work that out between the two agencies, and that's why that is not in the bill. The other issue that Director Pagel brought up was our saying that they needed to pay for the water. And that's our protection if this all crashes. If the ODFW people and other agencies resist this transfer, we still need to be able to protect ourselves, and we feel that we should be able to do that in the language of the amendments that say that they need to lease the water if they insist they have to have it.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Babbitt, when was your property first offered for sale, formally?
Senator Ferrioli represented Measure 8. We looked at selling in the mid-80s, and I believe we had it offered for sale at that time. We couldn't find a buyer because the site is very complex and there's a lot of things going on. We dealt with the state and went through the appraisal process, and that was in 1993, 1994, when it looked like we were seriously going to have a listing.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. We have a floor session beginning in a few minutes, so we'll be adjourning today. Appreciate the attendance and the attention of the committee. Thank you very much.